As Kitty mentioned, a big part of what I do is outside of the traditional frame of what architects do, and it's really aimed at recognizing the need for more holistic approaches to problem solving, which reach beyond the traditional boundaries of what any single profession is able to offer. And as such, the idea of leveraging partnerships for common mutual interests is something that I'm sort of living, you know, ongoing living example of how to make that work. So NOMA as an organization, as you can see, has got a pretty clear mission. We recently reduced a one-page, three-paragraph diatribe of a mission statement down to a single sentence, which is something I think that is wise for all organizations to do, to be as clear as possible in terms of what their intent is. And while this is our mission, again, I return to the discussion today to talk about how necessary it is to actually step outside of the boundaries or the box, as it were. So, a disaster. These are all sensations that I think we, as humans, experience initially. Now what? You know, we've seen it, we've felt it in our hearts. When I get up in the morning, before I put on my uniform as an architect, I'm a human. We all are. And as a result, we have a response and a calling to do something. And the question at that precise moment is, do we retreat back inside of our box, or do we find a way to step out of the box? So we all remember this day and this time indelibly. Katrina struck. We were kind of waiting for it. We had advance notice. We're going to compare Haiti and the Gulf Coast in this conversation. And in many ways, in having to prepare for this, it gave cause and purpose to do forensics on a disaster. And one of the things is that depending on the location and the resources that exist within a place, that will have a heavy bearing on the outcome. And in our case, even though as devastating as New Orleans was, the issues of food, clean water, and some of the other things that had a magnified impact in Haiti, while they were significant in the Gulf Coast, we're still America, and as embarrassing as our response was, when we go to Haiti, it's hard to really compare. So these photographs are from a visit I made to the Gulf Coast not long after Katrina, into the lower Ninth Ward in particular. And I don't need to rehash many of them, just enough to sort of remind everyone of what some of these residents had to go through immediately in the aftermath. And I'm sorry that this quote from then President Bush is probably not so visible, but these are trying times for the people of these communities. We know that many are anxious to return to their homes. It's not possible at this moment. Right now, our priority is on saving lives, and we are still in the midst of search and rescue operations. So our focus is on saving lives. That's going to come up in my conversation about stepping outside of the box. So more recently, this is another date that is sort of marked in our memory. And as we look at Haiti several months after the earthquake, we see conditions that are deplorable, that are threats to human health and dignity. And as an architect, you can imagine, as I walked through the streets of Port-au-Prince and witnessed the magnitude and extent of destruction, that I was simply quiet for quite a while. I couldn't really react or respond. It was quite surreal. And then what kind of brought me back was, as we see in this photograph, the people. Now, there's the good news and the bad news. And the good news is that the people of Haiti are tremendously resilient. And the bad news is the people of Haiti are tremendously resilient. So as we look at, in the foreground, what is a similar nature of commerce that existed the day before the earthquake, it has actually resumed and is raging in the streets of Port-au-Prince, albeit in and amidst the debris and rubble. And of course, waiting for the rains and waiting for the winds, we have just a calculation here. So President Obama said, the situation on the ground remains dire and people should be under no illusions that the crisis is over. He could have said that the day after and he could have said it yesterday. So as I started to think through what myself as a human wants to do to respond, and then falling back into my box, what I'd like to be able to do with the professional training that I have as an architect and a planner, it occurred again that there's sort of a graph of a disaster in phases, and that there's the immediate phase where the outcome needs to be focused on survival. Once the kind of four pillars of survival, as I like to say, which are food and clean water, sanitation, basic power, and I've just brain dumped on my fourth pillar, but these essentials have to be addressed by all of us, irrespective of what our professional training is. We want to look through a lens of immediate survival. But once that is attained, then we move to what I call the interim phase of a disaster, which is where we focus on stabilization. And I think that we're still very much in an interim phase in Haiti. We've kind of graduated in New Orleans now through that interim phase to more of a long-term phase where the outcome is sustainable well-being. But I'm still going to focus more on my talk this morning and what little time I have remaining on the initial phases. And so it really does come down to becoming active and engaged by any means necessary. And I should also note that what has sort of emerged as a learning moment for me is that the lens through which we in our culture and society view the urgency of response is not universal. And in fact, a culture that has generations of a certain clock of how things occur and how what kind of expectations there are in time is very different. And so while we all are frustrated with the slow progress in our paradigm, it's also viewed by people who are accustomed to this. Not that this is something we should settle for, but we have to understand as we try to engage with our paradigm and assistance that if it doesn't happen and the doors don't, you know, fling wide open and the welcome mat rolls out, that we have to understand the complete cultural context in which we're trying to operate, and we have to make our plans accordingly. So I wanted to show a few quick examples of the things, the technologies, as simple as they are, that are available to address these essentials of survival, one being clean water. And this is just one of many systems, but one I chose to show today by a Swedish company that's very low tech, and it's basically a vessel that allows, you put water in it, you put it in the sun, and it has a signaling mechanism when the water's been purified to be drinkable, to be potable. And after that, it can be used as hot water for cooking or hygiene purposes. What we see on the right is a tent encampment in Port-au-Prince where there's a public bathing area, for lack of a better word, and citizens come and use it openly with no privacy, and so this issue of dignity is something that I have been holding on to as one of the sort of fundamental ideas of how whatever approaches we offer have to have that as one of the fundamental aspects. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with this late technology, the Bloom Energy Bloom Box, but it's generated by a scientist who works for NASA. He was working on a system for the Mars program to create water out of a chemical reaction to sustain a colony on Mars, and that program got canceled recently. He started to think about the technology and started to apply it more to the creation of power. So in a nutshell, the Bloom Box combines oxygen with a biofuel, and a chemical reaction occurs which produces electricity. There's now a full-blown company. You can go on a stock exchange and I think buy their stock. I happen to have a very famous cousin, General Colin Powell, and he sits on the board of Bloom Energy, and that's how my light bulb went on about it. I'm looking at it. But a small little box can power a single-family home. A Bloom server, which is a larger module you see in the slide, fits in a parking stall, can provide power for a small office building or 100 homes, and have a very, very minimal resultant output of CO2. So we know that these technologies now exist, and the question is, how do we bring them all together? And this gets back to the idea of facilitating partnerships, and these partnerships and your role as a facilitator may have little or nothing to do with your professional training. This is a matter of what can we do to take advantage of our unique position in this world to either connect people, organizations, our constituents, our groups, toward ideas that sort of transcend the professional discipline. In the case of this system here, it's a complete biogas digester in a shipping container that takes human waste, converts it, kills all the bacteria, converts it to usable agricultural fertilizer, and the methane that is siphoned off can power the motor that turns the biogas digester, rainwater collection from the roof, and small solar panel capacity to back up the biogas. And so what's frustrating to me is that these systems are out there. There are $11 billion worth of pledged funds for Haiti in this case, and how do you start to connect the dots to allow these systems to flow into the area when you know that every day matters? So phase two, about stabilization, I wanted to just show one project on the left by a colleague, a fellow NOMA member, Rodney Leon, who's a Haitian national who lives in New York City, has an architectural practice, and along with some colleagues created a design that they call the Soft House. It's a hexagonal floor plan which can be erected as a single standalone unit or can be joined at the along one of the edges and form any scale of habitation that's appropriate. The other slide is one of a series of designs that were put forth in the Housing Expo competition, which has been ongoing. And the idea was that Bill Clinton said if he got another design delivered to him for another clever housing project, he was going to, well, I can't really say in this audience what he said he would do with it. But the bottom line is that there's no shortage of good ideas. The idea is, how do you bring a project, a demonstrable project, and get it executed? In New Orleans, we see that we've now passed that process of competitions for housing. What we're looking at here are a combination of housing designs that are, on one hand, being erected in Brad Pitt's Make It Right 300 housing unit development, which is very controversial, and after visiting it and interviewing some residents informally, I have to say that's the subject of another talk, not today, but let's just say that the outsider's involvement within a culture and a community, while it may have a positive outcome down the line, at least initially, is another layer of granularity in the complexity and the messiness of a rebuilding effort. The lower right is a much more of a sensible infill house that's been done by the Tulane City Center in partnership with the Neighborhood Housing Services of New Orleans, which I'm proud to say is a partner with NOMA. NOMA, by the way, is kind of a little brother to the AIA. How many of you know about the AIA? You hear about architects. The AIA is American Institute of Architects, 83,000 members. There are 100,000 licensed architects in America. 1,750 are African American. 250 are women, African American women. So my organization, although it carries a big stick and it wields a lot of influence, is a 600-member organization, and half of those are students. Enough said, why partnerships are so important to us. So, to closure, nothing about us without us is for us. That is a Native American philosophy that I ripped off rather conveniently. I like to use it because it embodies so much. And so what do? We first ask the question, what do you need? How best may we help? In other words, don't walk in with the answer. And this sort of reinforces what I said before, that we're trained in a way that we take a very structured approach to problem solving. And these disasters don't allow initially the time for that. And so what we do is, as a group of diverse professionals, we have to be willing to work outside of that traditional box. And then as the timeline extends, we're able to increase our traditional role as professionals and function more back in our fields. But initially, that operating as an architect, or, you know, except for doctors, what you do is probably the inverse, where the health system is maxing out immediately in terms of its impact, and then, you know, more or less flattens out as we go along. But for the rest of us who are trying to partner and be part of the solution, we react initially as servants, and then we work our way back into our chosen fields. So ultimately, strategic partnerships offer the best benefit to these disaster-stricken locations. And these partnerships are really about a series of steps: getting to know your partner first, establishing why it makes sense to be a partner, understanding that the sum is greater than the individual parts, and that the value and respect are the fundamental tenets of having a successful partnership. We, NOMA, have partnerships with the AIA, with the U.S. General Services Administration, the National Urban League, CHF International. Immediately after the disaster, as architects, we thought shelter, and we immediately did a major tent drive, and we did it in partnership with CHF International, since they already had the infrastructure. They deliver tents to more disaster-stricken areas than any other NGO in the world, I understand. So we were successful in meeting a goal that they set out for us. And then Architecture for Humanity. They're on the ground in Haiti, they're on the ground in New Orleans, and they bring young students and young practitioners, or any age, together to work toward grassroots community building, physically and socially. So with that, I'll conclude and just say that we need to be partnered up. And we're very committed to, you know, our human brothers and sisters, men, women, children, trying to take the privilege that we enjoy here and extend some of that in a way that will be helpful and beneficial. Thank you.
Well, for me, I would like to see more responsible research done by public health researchers and schools. I'd like to see them work more closely with the community and respond to the health threats that communities identify. That's always an issue. It's in one way they chase the money, and the money isn't always exactly what, you know, communities need. And where I live, because it's such a close relationship between money and the petrochemical industry, a lot of times we don't get the kind of research that we need. For instance, with lead in the soil and the cultural tradition of backyard gardens that's so prevalent in the city of New Orleans, you know, actually working with communities to do the research on how, what plants should be used to remediate the soil, what's working, doing some testing of backyards and things like that for the elderly, especially who want to grow plants, and putting this forward as a, you know, real research effort would be very helpful. Along with a lot of, I'll give you the Katrina cough, you know, that everybody was talking about. We were just told it was in our minds or that it wasn't real. And there's never been a resolution to the Katrina cough issue, which makes community people really suspect of public health researchers when every time we have an issue, it's just washed away. And there's no advocate for actually responding to health needs as it relates to whatever disaster we're dealing with. I would just like to see more researchers. I'm an environmental sociologist, which means I work with toxicologists, epidemiologists, and risk assessors. And I say that under my breath. I fight with risk assessing people. But I'd just like to see a more progressive, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, but almost like trying to find a cure when we found penicillin. We don't have that kind of active research going on as it relates to insults to humans after disasters or because of industrial pollution.
I would say make sure, you know, for Haiti there's just so much, and if you have to get a little pie, you know, small pie for now, but conduct a thorough investigation of an NGO or organization that you'd like to support or work with. There are so many of them. There are a lot of them, like Partners in Development, Partners in Health, you know, Doctors Without Borders. Then there are the smaller groups. But my concern was that I did give money to the Clinton Foundation. I've not yet seen any kind of influx of support. And I'm thinking maybe they're waiting until after the elections. So I would say if you're interested in supporting or doing something, there's so many different groups that you can contact on the ground in Haiti that you can work with, from health issues to environmental issues. They need your support and help in the community. That's the resiliency. The community is really working to try and solve their own problems, but our support can be with them.
Thank you, and I want to recognize Claude Jacoby, who just asked the last question, is a major planner for this session, so thank you. Gentlemen at the...
So my name is Dr. Shelby Wilson. I'm the chair of the environment section, and so I help applaud one of the session. And so the idea behind the session is talking about how can we build these partnerships. So to respond, remember the response in many cases is short term, but many times particular disasters, people leave, organizations leave. So how can organizations like APHA, work organizations like NOMA, work with community-based organizations, environmental sociologists like Dr. Wright, and really have, we know we have underserved communities who have infrastructure disparities already in the U.S. and the Caribbean. So how can we have sort of response teams? We know there can be hurricanes and climate change, more frequent, more intense hurricanes. So what can APHA's role be to facilitate that? Let the APHA can be more active. I'm not saying it's not active, but in some ways, since we're so big, we're all doing our individual session work, we can be so passive in how we really put ourselves out there and have the courage to address some of the social injustices that drive these infrastructure disparities that leads communities being at risk in the first place and vulnerable to natural disasters. So I want to, Dr. Taylor's question to you. How can you get your role with all your stickers?
Yeah.
Okay,
that's
what you really do. I think they can play a
occupational health and safety section. That was my initial section. We developed within the section the Nicaraguan Technical Aid Project, right? APHA supported this development, but it came from, again, from the grassroots, from one of the sections. So I think the international health section, the environmental health section, the occupational health and safety section could, you know, collaborate to develop some sort of technical aid project that could then go after support for the project and the efforts in Haiti. As an executive board member, APHA doesn't do the funding for specific projects unless we receive grants, you know, so it could be at some point if there was funding from there. We have the climate change project now that's funded by, I think it's EPA, nor is it DHHS, but there's something that APHA has now that's funded for a big project that's there at APHA. But from a financial standpoint, it has to come from other sources, and that the drive or the direction would not be from the board or from APHA itself, but from the sections.
I want to add to that, and that the key operative piece is to have a project. So if you identify a particular area of need that you want to wrap your energy around, work with like-minded colleagues inside and cross-disciplinary with architects, planners, the whole gambit, come up with the project and understand how far you can go before you can't go any farther. Most of that is when you get to the money piece. Mm-hmm. Now, with $11 billion pledged and Bill Clinton scratching more than his head wondering where it's going to come from, a lot of it I've determined is the lack of demonstrable projects that are ready to go. They just need the money piece to be implemented. And so what NOMA's trying to do is, for example, one of the slides about the shipping container that has the biogas digester is to connect the dots with people in power, both here in the Clinton Foundation, OAS, the other organizations, to illustrate a demonstrable project with a number, with a budget attached to it, and at the same time, going completely around the other end, get the local entity on the ground in Haiti that will be the host and the essential benefactor of that effort. So you really empower, walk away from it, let it replicate and sustain. But we might have the leadership and we might have the innovation necessary to start something, but we really need to start it for and with that population such that it's very sustainable.
Okay, thank you. I realize we're five minutes over. If you are willing to stay another 5 minutes, it depends on how fast the questions are. We might be able to take all four individuals at the mics, or we may only be able to address one question. Sir, did you have a question? I'm not recognizing you for a question. I just didn't know if you had some technical suggestions. Okay, so Dr.
Yeah, I just want to very quickly say that from where I sit, I think we almost need to start from scratch. Someone needs to organize a conference, you know, where we invite people in from APHA in the public health field. It's almost like it needs to go across the United States, like one in the South, and look for community-based organizations and community problems where people are coming, identifying what their needs are, and then maybe setting up some kind of board for rapid response. The United States is huge, so you'd almost have to do a regional kind of approach. NIEHF did that years ago with the health issues, and so the community university partnership grant starting out of EPA and the community participatory research grants, all of that started first with talking to communities and came out of that big conference. So there's really already a guidepost for getting this done with agencies. So we can just turn it around and you do it with APHA. And then there's an organization of scientists, you know, they have this group and they work with us. We've been meeting with them now. So I think we need, I think that the groundwork is there. It can be done, but it needs to be organized. And we need to ask these agencies for money to do it.
Do it for it.
Thank you. Let's do this. Why don't each of you pose your question, or four of you, and then I will have our panelists respond.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll start with you.
Good morning. I'm Linda Trundell with Houston Independent School District. And at the time of Katrina, I was an administrator at a high school that brought in over 300 evacuees, many from Lower Ninth Ward. Clearly, we were very aware of the challenges of the school district in New Orleans at the time. And I know now they're bringing in a lot of charter schools. Now, Mr. Lewis used the Native American expression, nothing about us, without us, is for us. And I'm curious about the education system now. Is it seen as coming up from within New Orleans, or is it being seen as something that's being brought to New Orleans from the outside?
Okay. Thank you. And if you would ask your question, please.
Good morning. My name is Diana King, and I have a question for Dr. Wright and Dr. Taylor. I'm an urban planner by trade, and I've been working in environmental justice and the environment for the past 10 years. And for Dr. Wright, I would like to ask, because I thought your plans that the community and you, everyone worked on was very detailed and very prioritized in a very good way, what accountability factors have been put in place to hold people accountable to work on those plans collectively, and how can we support even if we don't live in New Orleans? And for Dr. Taylor, the group of young women who actually need support for school, are we looking at any type of way to adopt an orphanage to help young girls, to help young children go to school who reach that level?
Thank you. And move to this side. Could you speak a little more loudly, please?
Is it on?
Yes.
No.
It is.
My name is Anitra Patterson. I'm a student member of APHA. This is my first conference, and I'm very proud to be here to speak with you yesterday and to see the need of justice, social justice for APHA. APHA has long been a focus of social injustice. Starting from its history and the history of the interaction of the United States with the Haitian people. And right now, after I was in D.C. in October, as an observer to lead the Action Committee, which is a group of Haitians and friends of Haiti, that organizes these kinds of observational trips, I met with a few people who were doing projects in Sophie, in Portland Plants, having to do with schools, education, and old ladies who cannot live in the encampments for various social reasons. All apparent to everybody is that the money, the billions of dollars that were donated by the American people and others into the fund that Bush and Clinton have control of are not getting into the cities. All that rubble was supposed to have been paid for by this money. But the rubble is still there, and they're able to employ a few, people are able to employ a few young folks and clear it away bit by bit. But where are the big machines to do this? Where's the big effort? What I want to know, in terms of social justice, how can we get that money out of the hands of the Bush Clinton group and into the hands of the Haitian people?
Thank you. And sir, you have the last question. Thank you. Well, why don't we start from this side with Dr. Taylor?
Okay, the first question about the young girls, and they're also young men. We have about 30 individuals who have now going to be timed out and put out of the workforce. Since I left, I heard that several of them were actually hired by the orphanages as counselors. Then the others are in a group home with a mom, so to speak. And there were personal donations. I made donations. Other people have made monetary donations to keep the women in this facility. I actually gave a presentation to my church, and they're donating money. So it's sort of like, piece by piece. But the amount of money to send them to secondary school is not a lot compared to what we would have to pay in this country. So donation, you know, $500, you know, so I'm, step by step, we're trying to do something in order to fund those young women. So right now they are in a secure spot. They've lost one.
Do they have the capacity on the ground to educate them if they have the money?
They do. They've actually identified, they have the capacity to educate the children. They've identified schools for them. And the children, those girls, they all have dreams of what they'd like to be. You know, one wants to be a secretary, one wants to be a cosmetologist. So we're just trying to place them very carefully in programs. And the one who left, they haven't heard from her. They don't know where she is. Is she gone? That can happen. Now, I don't know the question that you asked about where the money is. I wanted to ask the same thing since I was there. But I think Stephen said he can answer that for me.
Well, possibly not answer, but give some insight into why the debris removal is so incredibly protracted at this point. One of the buildings that collapsed was the Land Ownership Records Ministry. And so, believe it or not, one of the huge impediments to being able to designate areas to dump the rubble is the fact that there are no accurate records of who owns the land, including the government, what land the government owns. In terms of quick and things that seem quick and easy, like, well, just truck it out to a barge and take it out and dump it in the ocean, well, the environmental impacts of that are being sort of front and center in you know, the analysis required before they'd be able to do that. There are also the cultural issue that there are still remains. So it's not debris removal,
yeah.
It's debris and remains removal, and those are very, very sensitive issues. So again, what I talked about, how we view this time scale in our lens versus how the culture on the ground has to process all of this, you know, messy stuff, it's there's no one real answer. But I again believe that with the control of the money being at the Clinton Foundation, Bill Clinton trying to organize the NGOs, that to the extent that groups can arrive at the door with a implementable project that simply requires the funding and it has a connection with the local on the ground, I think that's probably going to be the best way. And after several of these projects are demonstrated, that money will start to flow.
Can I mention just one other thing? One of the things that we talked about, we met several, not only we stayed at one orphanage, but we had connections to several other orphanages up north and also in the south in Haiti. Coalitions, you know, coalition building within the country needs to happen as well. Like those orphanages have large, you know, groups of children who are still there, they're getting older, they need to coalesce together to come up with some plans. Like the building we talked about, we talked at each one of the places that we visited about building community gardens. They do need, however, big equipment. One of the things that I'm trying to do, I used to work for the United Auto Workers, and we still represent workers, thank God, with Caterpillar and some of those big, big pieces of equipment. So the hope is that we can get some of that equipment sent to Haiti on the ground to get things moving. So that's something I'm working on the side to try and do as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, in response to the question related to charter schools, one of the slides that I took out of my presentation was on charter schools. I looked at who I was speaking to and didn't think it was relevant. But the charter school situation in New Orleans is really a contentious project. We have outsiders who have come from as far away as Turkey, and they've started charter schools in our neighborhoods. The New Orleans public school system, as you know, was completely devastated by the storm in that the school board, which was corrupt, there are lots of them, but all of our school teachers were fired. That had a rippling effect on the city, especially it was 98% African American children, 98% African American teachers. Although there was a fund to pay the teachers for 2 years, and it's in court now, those teachers were paid in the other parishes. The only teachers who didn't receive the money were the New Orleans Parish School teachers, and they were mostly African American. What has happened is now this charter school system has just come in, and you know, our president loves it, and we're just a big human experiment. We have all of these charter schools. It's like they disrespect the whole field of education, and if I were in education, I would be insulted that you think you can take a young kid at 21, right out of college, and put them in a classroom, and they're supposed to teach where people have PhDs. it's a field. And they're almost kicking out everything related to everything that we know about teaching children. Our school system was in trouble, as are many of the school systems in the country. But if our public school system had been given the autonomy that the charter schools have now and the money, our kids would be doing just fine. We put out a lot of money on charter schools, and when we look at the test scores, they're just slightly higher than what they were before they got the money. And the New Orleans public school system has had 2/3 of their schools are charter, and I call them MAC charters, like Machiavellian. They had to become charters to survive because all the money was going to the charter system, and the New Orleans public school system is doing very well now with the 13 or 14 schools that they had. It's just a travesty. And anytime you say something against charter schools, people tell you, you know, well, you're a doctor, you have money, your children can go to any school. Why do you want to relegate poor kids to you know, these other schools? So then they pick this class thing that almost stopped you from being able to speak. It doesn't stop me. It does stop some people from being able to speak. The charter schools take in all the children. Many of them have selective enrollments, but at a certain date, October, they can kick any child out. And when they kick that child out, the money doesn't follow with them. That child then goes to the RSD school, a school with less money and more troubled schools. So to me, you're not helping our city if you don't help the least of us, because those are the children who end up in prison. The emphasis ought to be put on the kids who need it the most, not on the kids whose parents, because of their parents, are going to make it in any school. And that's what's happening to some extent. But I do want to give kudos to the New Orleans public school charter schools that are doing an unbelievable job, and they don't have selective admission.
That's good.
I want to say that. The other thing is about the plans for the city. There is no accountability. You know, I think that the study that we're doing is the first to look at where the money has been spent. So, you know, if nobody's looking at where the money has been spent, then there's no accountability. We have $30 million for hazard mitigation that's disappeared. We went through 5 years with our previous mayor, we couldn't find it. We found it with the new mayor, and now we've lost it again. So the soil mitigation money has disappeared. A lot of our problems, though, are not with the city. It's lost at the state. And you have to understand that New Orleans is a despised city. Everything else is rural and Republican. New Orleans is black and Democratic, what we call the Obama yuppies that have moved there. So people don't like us very much. It's a constant fight. And our block is that the ignorance of Louisiana politics and our Republican governor that has really put a clamp on a lot of the money that should have come to us. And I say that here, I say it to the newspaper, I say it on radio, that's our problem.
Wow. Well, thank you so much to our panelists.
Oh, there was a question about students. Call me.
Oh, yeah. Undergraduate students.
Yes.
You did ask that, and I didn't address it about the financial side. We are having problems raising money at our school, you know, for the students who want to go along. We started fundraisers, and then there are also Title III monies and other sources. So, I mean, it's a constant struggle to find funding so that students can go. But our next trip, which we're planning in January, if it takes each one of the faculty members, several of us, donating to a general fund, that's how we're going to have to do it. I know that people raised money initially to go to Louisiana. Students from Morgan, from Howard, they went down on the bus. They came down to assist. So there are all kinds of ways that students are getting together. I know, but there are all kinds of ways that, you know, people are working together, undergraduate students, the student councils, raising money to try and find funds to support Haiti, to support New Orleans. It's just, you know, it's always the thing on the front, up front of where do you get the money to do it.
I'd like to put in a plug for Southern University School of Architecture.
SUNO.
Yeah, because one of the problems right now, it's accredited, one of the highest accreditations, whatever. I'm not an architect. I know a lot of black architects, and that school is struggling for students.
Yes.
You know, they need more students. We need to start encouraging our young, talented people to go into architecture.
We're working on it.
We're going to lose our black architects.
We got projects.
Our schools are disappearing one at a time. Yeah. As our schools disappear, the number of students go down.
Through NOMA, we got very involved in the accreditation battle recently. Dean Lonnie Wilkinson's a good friend.
And so
we have NOMA has a program, an initiative called Project Pipeline. Strictly dealing with cultivating the next generation of architects of color. Why is that important? What we leave behind as a society from our generation will stand for generations ahead of us as some measure of who we were as a people and as a society. And if our voice creatively is not part of that composition, we don't help craft that landscape out there, then what people refer back to will be absent. We'll be absent from that conversation. We could very easily disappear. The strongest element of memory is in the built environment that we can leave.
Yeah.
When we talk about the Depression era, we talk about the WPA and all those wonderful buildings that Roosevelt was responsible for. That defined that great time of emerging from crisis. Do I want to be remembered for a 25-foot high metal fence along the Mexican border? I don't think so. So we need children, and we're working very, very across the country through all of our chapters on Project Pipeline. So stay tuned. And we have a relationship with the Priestley High School in New Orleans of Architecture and Design. We basically forced our way in there, and now we're very involved with those kids.
That's good.
Well, with that inspiring challenge among many that we heard this morning, we did not fill the room, but you all have stayed and participated in this very deep and important conversation. I want to thank our panelists again. I am inspired by them as much as we hear about the devastating human toll. We also heard great leadership and great inspiration, and I think for that, this panel has done the theme of this year's annual meeting proud. So thank you.